And our Animal Voices choir is tuned up, and ready to go. So let's start our show.
Economically and politically possible to do, and that is to place meaningful legislation in to regulate factory farms and to regulate the proliferation of animal factory farms in the Fraser Valley. If our governments took this leadership, then that would facilitate resolving environmental problems which are caused by this mass production of animals. We would return to a more natural and organic method of agriculture without the genetic manipulation and the use of pesticides and harmful products to our environment. That is a dream. Yes, you are listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, also known as Co-op Radio, your commercial-free and community-based and community-sponsored radio station. This program is presented to you by volunteer members of the Vancouver Humane Society, EarthSafe Canada, and the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. Alan Jensen is in the control room today. John Pranger, our webmaster and co-host, is here. Co-host Marge Adams is away exploring the glories of Cuba. My name is Carl Loskin, and shortly we'll be speaking with David Parker, who was a Green Party candidate in Edmonton Centre in Alberta. He is also on the board of Vegetarians of Alberta. Then, at the halfway mark, we will be speaking with Sinica Crossland, the president of TRAX. TRAX represents the name, is an acronym, for the Responsible Animal Care Society. She will be calling from the Okanagan town of West Bank. Well, welcome John Pranger, our webmaster.
Thank you, Carl. Having a little trouble with our mic, so just bear with us. Yeah, here's a message from our society, Carl, ADAV, Animal Defense Anti-Vivisection Society, from Robert Lawson Tate, a well-known gynecologist from Birmingham, who originated many of surgery's modern techniques still in use today. He said, like every other member of my profession, I was brought up in the belief that almost every important fact in physiology had been obtained by animal experimentation, and that many of our most valued means of saving life and diminishing suffering had resulted from experiments on animals. I now know that nothing of the sort is true concerning the art of surgery, and not only do I not believe that vivisection, animal experimentation, has helped the surgeon one bit, but I know that it has often led him astray.
Yes, John, thank you. Yes, John, thank you. You know, Chief Seattle said, what is the man without the beast, without the animal? If all the beasts were gone, men would die from a great loneliness of spirit. For whatever happens to the beasts also happens to man. All things are connected. Whatever befalls the earth befalls the children of the earth. Yes, in the past 2 years, we have had the warmest ever recorded in some of Greenland's coastal communities. The change in the average temperature of just a couple of degrees will change our whole way of living. And according to the World Watch Institute, and I took this from the webpage madcowboy.com, the World Watch Institute said, the upward trend in weather-related disorders has occurred in tandem with a rise in global average surface temperatures. Continued climate change will almost inevitably yield increased extreme natural events and large catastrophic losses. During the 1980s, World Watch said that the average annual economic losses from weather-related disasters worldwide was $8 billion. During the 1990s, the average annual economic losses from weather-related disorders worldwide was $40 billion. In the single year of 1998, the economic losses from the weather-related disasters to those that occurred throughout the entire decade of the 1980s combined was more than $12 billion. The past year's experience with Hurricane Katrina could eclipse all of those figures put together. One of the most potent greenhouse gases destabilizing the planet is methane. It is some 24 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, and its concentration in the atmosphere has been rising faster by about 1% per year for the last 50 years. Well, the National Cattlemen's Association, Beef Association, said it is a myth that U.S. cattle produce large amounts of methane, which they is a greenhouse gas, thereby contributing significantly to possible global warmings. So they denied the effect of methane and the millions of cattle on our in North America. Then there was a study that said the results of extensive research at the livestock range in Fort Crock Laboratory in Montana pointedly reveal the high level of dependency of the U.S. beef cattle industry on fossil fuels. 3 kilograms of greenhouse warming carbon gas released by driving a typical 3 kilograms of greenhouse warming carbon gas is released by driving a typical American car in one day. 75 kilograms of greenhouse warming carbon gas is released by clearing and burning enough Costa Rican rainforest to produce beef for one hamburger. Global warming has emerged as the most serious environmental threat of the 21st century. Only by taking action now can we ensure that future generations will not be put to risk. The World Watch Institute said that American feed, and they referred to livestock, takes so much energy to grow that it might as well be a petroleum byproduct. The two worst things people do to the planet in their daily lives, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists, is to drive vehicles that get poor gas mileage and to eat beef. Once again, this information came from www.madcowboy.com. So over to a little bit of lighthearted music and over to Alan Jensen. Thank you, Alan, for that light-hearted music. Yes, our webpage is www.animalvoices.org. Many of our programs can be heard on the internet by going to our webpage. And also, if you can't hear us clearly from wherever you are, you can go to coopradio.org and stream us right into your listening area. Well, David Parker was a Green Party candidate for the Edmonton Centre. And he is also the editor of the newsletter of the association called Vegetarians of Alberta. Welcome to Animal Voices, David.
Hi there, Carl.
Yes. Well, you know, we're so interested to hear from you because you're living there in Edmonton Centre, and you were a candidate in the last Green Party. So tell us, how did it go for the Green Party in Alberta?
Pretty good. We got the highest per capita vote in the whole country. You guys used to be on top in BC. Now it's Alberta. We're number one. My own personal vote went up by 20% from. I also ran in 2004, so I got an increase of 20%. And the party across the country, in spite of dropping a little bit in British Columbia and the Atlantic provinces, we went up by 15%.
That's tremendous, and well, congratulations for what you're doing in what is so often considered to be redneck country. How many people actually voted for the Green Party in Canada? Well, throughout the country?
Throughout the country, 2/3 of a million, 666,000 people, under that, actually.
And how many candidates did you get into the parliament?
We had the whole slate of candidates, as we did in 2004, 308 candidates. How many people did we actually get elected, are you asking?
That's correct.
Well, we actually got none at all. That's something fundamentally wrong with the electoral system in Canada. People have probably been hearing about the need to change to a proportional representation system. Well, the Greens are, that's one of our main objectives and one of our main platforms.
Just give us a brief outline of why you would, how it would be fairer.
Well, the first past the post system, which is the one we have, was designed in Britain back in the 12th century. It's in the feudal days of Britain, when there was the elite aristocracy and masses of other peasants and people who didn't really rate as human beings, and. Set up so that you could have a representative from your particular area represented in Parliament, and it's been with us. Canada adopted it from Britain, so did India, and actually United States is the only other country of those four that has a first-past-the-post system. It's very distorts people's wishes, electoral wishes, very radically. Ends up people vote against the person they want and the party they want, as opposed to voting for the party they want. It doesn't faithfully represent people's wishes in any way, shape, or form. For example, in British Columbia, not last election, but I think it was the one before last, where the NDP actually got fewer votes than the Liberals in the time before they got elected. But they formed the government. Radical distortions like that. Here in Alberta, we have the Conservatives, who have a majority government with most of the seats, but they're actually less than 50% of the population voted for them. So there's all kinds of distortions like that. Really throws things out of whack and doesn't give people the democratic kind of justice they are entitled to.
Now, David Parker, you increased your amount of votes that you got in Edmonton Centre. And what platform were you running on with the Green Party?
I ran on the whole Green platform, which is 216 recommendations. You can get it online, www.greenparty.ca. But my main party policies were proportional representation and Kyoto Accord. And something else as well, moving towards something called the Genuine Progress Indicator. Right now in the Western world, in most of the world, we use something called the Gross Domestic Product to measure how well we're doing and what, you know, It's a measure of society, and we live by that measure. But unfortunately, the gross domestic product measures everything, every single financial transaction that goes on, good, bad, or indifferent. So if I'm riding my bike through Edmonton and I get hit by a truck or something and I have to be taken to hospital and all that money spent on trying to fix me up and what have you, and not to mention all the other ancillary things, that goes on to the gross domestic product. So it's and when the Valdez, Exxon Valdez dropped all that oil in Alaska there, that also, $2 billion went on to the gross domestic product of the United States, cleaning it up. So it's not a very good measure of how well we're doing it. And so we in the Green Party, and along with a lot of progressive economists, think we should change it to something called the Genuine Progress Indicator.
Does that include the ability to price items for the environmental damage that it does? So if an item is damaging to the environment, it should cost us more. A whole pricing system maybe needs to be revised as well. Do you consider that?
Yeah, there are various. There's still, the economists are still kind of debating on what the best way to measure GDP, GPI is, gross genuine progress indicator. So there's no fixed model yet to for people to hang their hats on. But yeah, generally speaking, we do measure everything, regardless of whether it's good, bad, or otherwise. But we also have another policy platform, a major one we've had since the beginning, called the Green Tax Shift in the Green Party, which I think addresses the question you're asking there. We believe that we need to start investigating the things we give tax breaks on and subsidies to, and investigate whether they're bad for people's health, like factory farming and so on and so forth, and, producing oil in the Athabasca oil, tar sands, and its contribution to greenhouse gases and this, that, and the other. And we should think about the subsidies we've been giving to those kind of industries over the decades and, rethink the way we what we promote in society. As you so rightly say, things that should be good, the things we support should be good for us, and the things we penalize should be bad for us.
Now, in January, I believe you had the warmest month ever recorded in Edmonton.
That's right. It's actually just the last couple of days we had a taste of winter. It dropped down to about minus 23 yesterday. It's coming back up again today, but for the whole of January and half of February, it barely got below zero. A lot of days it was above zero, which is totally unheard of in Edmonton. And to me, that's a symptom. It seems to be a direct sign of climate change. People think that climate change, they think it's like sitting on the deck all year round, drinking margaritas and everything. But throughout the whole world, there's only going to be a change of maybe 1 degree Celsius on average. That means the average temperature will go up, not the overall temperature over time. Substantially. So what we will get, and what scientists are saying will happen with global climate change, is there'll be major fluctuations and disturbances and perturbations, like hurricanes, like we saw down in Louisiana, like the melting of the ice caps and flooding, like we've seen in Britain and various places in the world, and droughts, heat waves, like we saw in Toronto last summer. So that's the way I think climate change will play out.
Right. So now we're curious about how the misconception is of the people in Calgary and Edmonton. And you said, Calgary, they were quite a few votes for the Green Party. So
yeah.
It's maybe this whole idea that it's redneck and environmentally is maybe not correct.
No, it seems like it's redneck because we got this very sort of redneck government. But like I said, it's largely a result of the electoral system we have. There's some very, very progressive people, certainly here in Edmonton. I think in Calgary, too, although I don't go down there very much. But we got health food stores. We got totally vegetarian restaurants and partially vegetarian restaurants. We've got fitness groups. We've got people biking around all year round. I personally bike 365 days a year. So, you know, we're not all like that by any stretch of the imagination. Don't flee to British Columbia thinking you're going to go to Lotus Land. We got a bit of Lotus Land right here in Edmonton.
Of course, the Calgary Rodeo gets so much publicity, it sort of stains the image, from what's happening. But you've also become involved with the vegetarians of Alberta.
Yeah, we were 1989 or 88, I think we started. So what's that? 18 years now, and it's been growing ever since. We're still basically focused mostly on Edmonton and surrounding area. I've been trying to persuade the Calgary group, the Calgary Vegetarian Society. If anybody's listening from that group, you can adopt our name. You're welcome to join us and become the southern chapter of the Vegetarians of Alberta, so we can be truly the provincial vegetarian group. But we put out newsletters on a regular basis for about four times a year. We have potlucks every second Sunday of every month. We help the animal rights group here in Edmonton called Voice for Animals and any other animal rights groups. So we're focused on those issues, plus the environmental impacts of vegetarianism, which I think possibly a lot of your listeners may be familiar with, but I'll just explain it anyway. The impact of meat on the ecology is very, very high, very in terms of water, energy, land use, land degradation, and so on. And I've heard it said by people much more expert than myself, Howard Lyman being one of them, who's a very good friend of mine. He says that the one single thing any person can do to improve the environment throughout the world is to go vegan, actually. That's the biggest step you can make. I just read in my Guardian Weekly last week that there's massive amounts of rainforest being cleared so that they can grow soybeans in Brazil to feed the Chinese appetite, because, unfortunately, the Chinese are moving towards a meat-based diet.
That's right. The World Trade Organization was financing slaughterhouses for the meat to be used by McDonald's. But John has a question for you, David.
Okay.
Hi, David. Yes, you know, the EPA and the World Wildlife Fund has begun, or it was about a year old now, a new program to retest or test thousands of chemicals that have either come onto the market without being properly tested or have been tested, but it needs to be retested according to these people. Mm-hmm. It's being done through animal experimentation, which is, of course, how these products got onto the market in the first place. This massive program is going to kill millions and tens of millions of animals, and the problem is it's not going to solve the pollution problem, because we're using the same stale methods that haven't worked in the past to keep these products on the market, to bless them with safety data, and it will seem like the government is doing something about pollution, whereas in fact it's not, and it's helping the companies to stay in business. Can you have you heard about this program, and is the Green Party doing anything about it?
I've not heard about that specific program, no, but I know that society generally has evolved in such a way that we're producing all these chemicals all the time, majority of which we just sort of test, as you say, on animals, and a large number of them, the tests aren't adequate. They don't truly tell us whether the products are safe or not, and plus the fact that it's incredibly inhumane to test on animals, too. I suggest you get in touch with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine in Washington, D.C. They're doing a lot of work on animal testing.
Yes, they're actually involved in this program, trying to shut it down. And
yeah.
In Britain, there's a group called Doctors and Lawyers for Responsible Medicine, also an anti-vivisectionist group, which is also trying the same thing. Mm-hmm. And as well, the animal rights group PETA is involved. So far, there's been a great deal of reluctance, of course, to accept these the recommendations of these groups. But
yeah,
they are working on it. Maybe you can get involved in that too, because it's an extremely important issue.
Definitely, and the Green Party, there's a lot of issues to tackle, and we have to be sort of careful not to alienate the masses of people. It's still about getting votes and getting people elected, unfortunately, and it's a constant compromise between how radical or how progressive, shall we say, two are equal, really, do you become and risk losing votes? Because we lost a lot of votes in Atlantic Canada, especially in Newfoundland recently, because of our stand against the seal hunt. We're the only federal party that's completely condemned the seal hunt in Newfoundland. The other parties have been wish-washy about it, but, you know, that's the sad thing. It loses you. It can lose you votes. So
yes, of course.
Constant compromise being a political party like that.
Well, if I can just tie this principle into your ear that all animal experiments produce invalid results for human beings and for other animals, so they're a completely wrong system of doing things, and we need to abolish it soon.
I agree entirely. You don't have to convert me.
Good.
Well, one of the things that's close to you also is Feedlot Alley, and that's somewhere near Red Deer. Can you give us some idea of give our listeners some idea of what's there and how extensive is it, how big is it, how many animals do they keep at Feedlot Alley?
Actually, Feedlot Alley is not near Red Deer. It's way down south near Lethbridge, near the American border. But I don't know the statistics on it, but I do know that there's massive amounts of animals killed. Most of the so-called Alberta beef market comes from that particular area, and feedlots are not sustainable. They're totally unsustainable in terms of the waste products. The waste products produce methane. Methane is a greenhouse gas. It's 21 times more effective than carbon dioxide. We have another problem throughout the province, not necessarily Feedlot Alley, but it's pig barns. There's an outfit up in northwest Alberta battling against pig barns. About 2 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, the Alberta government took away the responsibility from municipalities to reject the big mega pig barns and gave it to the NRCB, National Resource Conservation Board, Natural Resource Conservation Board. Because what was happening was the people in the municipalities were rejecting these things because of the smell and because of the, the trucks coming in all the time and all the land degradation that goes on along with it. And the municipalities were rejecting it, so the Alberta government, in its usual despicable tactics, gave the responsibility to the NRCB, and the NRCB is basically an arm of government, so they pass these things without very much scrutiny, if you know what I mean.
Well, David, thank you, and congratulations for getting so many votes for the Green Party in Edmonton Centre. We'd like to give people your web page, which is www.vofa.ca.
That's vofa.ca, yeah.
Right. And they can have a look at there, and that's a wonderful web page with a lot of good information. Great to hear from you, and we'll be hearing from you soon again.
And go to the Green Party, too, greenparty.ca. That's another good website.
Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
Right.
Bye now.
You're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. Shortly, we'll be speaking with Seneca Crossland from West Bank in Okanagan. And we're just going to have a little break of music here while we sort out our microphones here.
Se acaba la yuca, se acaba el mar.
Yes, welcome back to Animal Voices. And we have a wonderful organization that's in Okanagan. It's called the Responsible Animal Care Society, and the acronym is TRACS. And their mission, in that they are a registered non-profit charity, they're dedicated to the kind of compassionate treatment of all living beings. In addition to a hands-on rescue work and crisis intervention, they actively promote public awareness in areas where animals are exploited for profit, abused, or denied natural conditions. Yes, and on their webpage they say, they quote Albert Schweitzer, who said, "We must seek to find a new spirit. Goodness and compassion should extend to all creatures." And on the line today, we have Sinica Crossland from the TRACS Society in Okanagan. Hello, Sinica.
Hello, Carl.
Good to hear from you, and you're dealing with so many issues. Really, maybe you can just tell us what's on your mind.
Okay, well, we finished doing an anti-fur demo on Saturday, the 11th of February, and our focus was the dog and cat fur in China. So that was one thing we did. We had a good turnout at the demo, and the interesting thing that actually came up was with regard to a question that someone from the media asked is, how can you tell if you're suspecting that some of the fur out there in the stores is indeed cat fur, not rabbit, because a lot of this fur from China is either unlabeled or can possibly be mislabeled, then how do you know that that can actually be, you know, that it may be cat? And so I said, well, the only conclusive way to tell would be DNA testing. And they were intensely interested in that and asked, are we considering doing that? And I said, yes, we have actually talked about it. And the sad part is we would have to buy a fur coat or some, you know, whatever they're selling, whether it's a shawl or a hat or whatever, and then send it off to the lab. We would have to purchase that. They can't just use a few fibers or a few hairs or anything, and they have to have the whole pelt sort of thing. And so then we would send that off to a lab, and it can be quite pricey. That's the other thing, but it is certainly something that we are considering doing.
And the other thing is, one might have to do quite a few tests, but it would really be explosive evidence for cat lovers and dog lovers if they knew that their coat that they're so proudly taking to the ski slopes was actually cat or dog.
Absolutely. It would be sort of a shock, I think, to a lot of people. Not that it's any less horrible what happens to rabbits, what happens to mink, the whole fur farming industry. It is a terrible thing for animals. But somehow people perhaps are a little closer to dogs and cats, and if they realize that, yes, this can actually be made of cat, and I have a cat at home, they could make that connection. So I think that's a really, really important point and something that animal welfare and rights groups can use, and, you know, to consider this. And it is, from what I've looked into it, it might cost about $800 to get a coat tested to find out what the origins are.
That's quite pricey if one has to multiply it by a number of times. But so I think it would be, if somebody could raise the funds, it would be just an incredible project to undertake.
Absolutely, because chances are when fur comes from China, it's all over Canada, it can be unlabeled, it can be mislabeled, then somewhere out there are fur coats that are actually from cat origin or dog origin. So it's just a case of finding them.
Now, do we have any legislation that would prohibit the sale of cat and dog fur in Canada?
We do not. That's another thing, and I encourage people to contact their MPs, contact the government, and ask for this kind of legislation to be enacted to ban the imports of dog and cat fur. And so I think that would be a huge, huge step that we could take in this country.
It would indeed. Now, you're involved with other projects as well, so you're very much involved with horses.
Yes, we do hands-on rescue of horses, and at this time we've got five looking for homes. Two of them are special needs horses, and they're wonderful horses, and so we hope to find good homes for them. And the other thing, I'm involved with the Canadian Horse Defense Coalition. It's www.defendhorsescanada.org, and it is actually a movement to ban horse slaughter in Canada, such as is being done in the United States. They're working really hard on that issue south of the border, and I really feel that this is the time for Canada to step up to the plate as well.
Thank you for sending me your newsletter, which is always a wonderful source of information which we can use here on Animal Voices. On the back page, you gave the shocking statistics of how many horses were slaughtered in Canada in the year 2004.
Yes, that's right. There were over 50,000 horses in 2004. I'm waiting for the stats to come in from 2005. They're not available yet from the government. But what I do have is dollar values, and it's kind of scary because by October of 2005, the dollar values of horse meat exported far exceeded the values for 2004. So, you know, I'm not entirely certain what this represents, to go from something like $6 million up to $14 million in Canadian dollars, exports to all countries. So if we look at that, it can either mean one of two things: either more horses went in 2005, or the horse meat had gone up. I'm not aware of horse meat having gone up that much. But there was, there have been the closures of the majority of the PMU farms, PMU standing for pregnant mare urine, and these are the creators of the hormone replacement drug Premarin. So with the closures of these farms, what this could represent might be some of those horses having gone for slaughter.
So now this hormone replacement has been discredited, and so has the company, the multinational company called Wyeth, who were extracting. Maybe you can just recap what was happening on the prairies, and has it declined? But it doesn't seem so with the number of horses that are being slaughtered in Canada now.
Well, the National Institutes of Health did a study a number of years ago, just a handful of years ago, I think it was in 2002, pointing towards health risks that women could suffer when they're taking Premarin or, you know, hormone replacement. And so as a result of this, farms started to close down where they were keeping these mares tied up and collecting their urine for the collection of Premarin or the hormone that they would make into Premarin, the estrogen. And so with over a period of time, these farms were closing down. It's at about two-thirds down now, so that it's probably about one-third functional. And it was sort of at right after that happened, and for about a year, there were horror stories of pregnant mares being sent for slaughter and things like this, and the rescue groups were going crazy trying to rescue them. And I'm wondering if some of this is still, if, you know, looking at the numbers for 2005 and the fact that it looks like a lot of horses could have gone for slaughter, if some of this could still be from those horses. But that remains to be seen. I'm waiting for the actual statistics of numbers, and we'll take it from there.
How are these horses slaughtered?
It's not very good. The group, the European group Animals Angels, did an investigation. They basically towards slaughterhouses and feedlots a couple of years ago. And when they went to the equine slaughterhouse in Western Canada, they observed a bison being slaughtered by being shot with a .22 in the head. It took three shots to kill the bison that they observed. Now, and they claim that they're doing horses in the same way. And so the horse, the terrified horse, goes into the killing box, is absolutely shaking with fear. This has been videotaped a number of times. And the horse smells the blood. Horses are very intelligent and sensitive, and they basically are just absolutely overwhelmed with fear. So then you have someone trying to shoot the horse in the head with a 22. Horses have very mobile necks. They're not like bison. Bisons have thicker skulls, so that could account for why it took 3 shots to kill a bison. However, with the horse in the killing box, you have a terrifying animal swinging its head to and fro. How many shots does it take to kill a horse?
Oh, shocking. Anyway, with the industry and women being persuaded by drug companies and physicians to take this drug, Premarin, discredited now, it developed a industry for the horse meat. Where is it going and how is it being sold?
The vast majority the horses are killed here in Canada, and there are 3 operating slaughterhouses here that I'm aware of, and the horse meat is sent overseas to places like Japan and Belgium and other countries of Europe and Asia, and some horses are actually shipped out alive, which is a concern as well, because if we're looking at we have laws here in Canada, supposedly, for the humane slaughter of horses, and I have some real concerns about that too. But when horses are exported live out of the country for slaughter overseas, all control over the butchering process is lost. So these animals are then at the mercy of foreign laws, and they can be dispatched by slaughterhouse personnel with minimal training. So that is a real concern as well. And horse slaughter is not a humane main process at all, and we should be remembering that it's a case of it's not just the physical pain that a horse may suffer if it's shot once, then twice, and perhaps 3 times. It is also the psychological pain, and we know as humans how terrible it is to be suffering psychological pain. Fear is a big thing, and these horses are very, very frightened. And according to an Ipsos Reid poll we conducted in May 2004, 2/3 of Canadians do not believe in the slaughter of horses for human consumption. It was 64%. So that is what the public is telling us.
I would think a large percentage of the people don't know that so many horses are being slaughtered for their meat.
That's absolutely correct, Carl. I run into people all the time who say, what? Horses are being slaughtered for meat? It's really quite amazing. There was I listened to a CBC show with there were a couple of people on there actually a day or two ago, and it was The Current, and Chris Hyde from an American organization was on there at the Society for Animal Protective Legislation, and he was the spokesperson for the pro-ban on horse slaughter. He's for the horses. The person, and this may surprise many, who was against the ban on horse slaughter was Terry Whiting, chairman of the Animal Welfare Committee for the Canadian Veterinary Medical Association. And he brought up concerns with regard, he said that he's all for humane transport and slaughter and this type of thing, and whether people eat horses or not is not a concern to him. He was concerned about where would all the horses go? If we were to ban horse slaughter in Canada, where would the horses go? And sure enough, on the surface, that is a concern. You know, you're going to have surplus horses there, but where would they go? Okay, so let's look at California and what happened there. In 1998, they outlawed the shipment of horses for slaughter in that state. And since then, there has been no increase in the amount of neglect. You know, it appears that people are stepping up to the plate and doing the responsible thing with their horses, adopting them out, finding homes for them, perhaps sometimes euthanizing them if they can't find a home, or if the horse is old or lame. And it should be noted that that according to the Southern California Equine Directory, there are over 700,000 horses in California. It is the second largest horse population by state in the U.S., Texas being the largest at 1 million. So we're talking about a lot of horses. Neglect has not increased because of this legislation being brought in. What is amazing also is that horse theft has gone down by 34%. So what is this but a good thing?
Right. John has a question, Seneca.
Sure.
Are foals also slaughtered in this way?
Yes, they are. They are generally fattened. They go to auction very typically around 3 months of age. And if the meat buyer can get them at that time, they do want to put some weight on them and so forth. So, you know, perhaps at 8 or 9 months old, they're sent for slaughter. Perhaps a year old, you know, depending. And, you know, by this time, you know, there's quite a bit of weight has been put on, but they are still foals. And it is a very, very sad thing.
Most people couldn't abide a job like that. How are people induced into working at such places? And I mean, what's the attraction?
Well, often I imagine when people go in, they're, you know, out of work. They need some sort of employment. There have been people that have worked in slaughterhouses who have been asked, what kind of a job was it? Many of them are, you know, and they're quite certainly it's not a very nice job to be doing, and there are lots of accidents that happen in slaughterhouses, you know, because they're working with knives and this type of thing. You know, it's there's a huge turnover in slaughterhouses as well, you know, so it can't be the best job in the world to have.
Yeah, you know, I have eaten horse meat myself because I'm Dutch, and I suppose a lot of this meat, it would be exported to Holland.
Probably Holland isn't usually listed as a country where they export. I've got the countries in front of me here. It says Japan, United States, Macau, and France is where they ship horse meat. Holland is not listed. However, you know, I know that they do Finland. You know, they have horse meat sold in Finland as well.
You know, I never made the connection between my love of horses and eating it. So it's a very strange disconnect that we human beings can have. And until that awareness really settles in our brain, we don't think anything of it, do we?
That's right. And it's just educating the public, making them aware that, you know, this there is a connection between what you're eating here and the live horse. And somewhere, all we can do is talk about it, get it out there, and, you know, as our Ipsos Reid poll showed, 64% of Canadians are against the slaughter of horses for human consumption.
Yeah, I know. I think there might be a resurgence of a call for the use of Premarin again by certain doctors. Do you think that has affected the industry? Well, you say you can't quite reconcile the numbers. Perhaps it has something to do with that. Have you heard of these?
There was just a very recent news article that I saw. It must have probably come out in the past week or two, and I still have to substantiate the source as to where they got this information that, you know, there's, and I know that the company Wyeth has been trying to promote a low dose alternative to the higher dose that they were selling before. So but I know that when this happened several years ago, women started to be more aware because it's a personal health concern, and they started to question, you know, what is it that I'm taking here, and perhaps there are alternatives. There are certainly many, many alternatives to taking Premarin. There are herbal alternatives. There's lifestyle, you know, cutting down on caffeine, not to smoke, do lots of exercise. You know, all these things help with menopausal symptoms.
Yes, and vegetable sources are a very good source, and
yes,
and not dangerous. Now, isn't it interesting that a doctor who founded the company, that it's a doctor who could think of such things, a doctor who ought to be compassionate and who ought to be able to empathize with the suffering of other beings, that it should be such a person who invents such a product is really quite astounding. And to me, it cries out for a huge reform of the medical profession.
Yes, yeah, and consumer beware. You know, that's, we always have to be aware of what's out there and the possible risks.
Now, in your newsletter, you also say there are very many tempting alternatives when we regard food choices. So maybe we can close off on an optimistic note of all the wonderful whole plant foods that are available for humans and to be able to lead healthy lives without animal suffering.
That's right. We had a little column in our newsletter with Brenda Davis, who's a dietitian and the author of 5 books, and she's working on a 6th one. And she wrote just a lovely, lovely piece for the newsletter that lists healthy plant food choices, and that we can be very, very healthy vegans and healthy-looking advocates for animals as well.
So thank you very much, Sinega Crossland. Maybe we can give people your webpage. Maybe you can give those 2 webpages there again.
Okay. TRACS, the Responsible Animal Care Society, is www.tracs-bc.ca and defendhorsescanada.org. So www.defendhorsescanada.org altogether.
Seneca, I'd like to thank you for the information that you've given us and for what you do in the Okanagan Valley.
Thank you so much, Carl, and you keep up the good work yourself there.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. Many of our programs can be heard on our webpage, which is www.animalvoices.org. And you can listen to us live with going to the internet, and it's www.coopradio.org. Over to Alan Jensen, and we'll have a little bit of music. Back to Animal Voices. My name is Carl Loskin, and we had quails. There was a wonderful bird called quails in the news in North America in the last week because of an incident that happened in Texas, I think. You know, the best known quail in North America is the northern bobwhite. Well, I've never heard of the bobwhite before, but this quail is abundant. They live in the brush. And they live in abandoned fields and open pine lands, but they really do avoid deep forests. And I think they look much like our grouse here, which is quite abundant in British Columbia. And in winter, these quails are found in flocks. And they have, these flocks are called coveys, C-O-V-E-Y. And when these frightened birds, when they are frightened, they prefer to run from danger when they are flushed, and they fly rapidly all at once with a loud whirring sound, a whole bunch of them together, and they quickly drop to earth. The females lay about 12 to 20 eggs. That's a lot of eggs for a quail, and of course quail eggs unfortunately are also popular, and they are incubated by both parents for 23 to 24 days. So it's a happy family that raises the chicks. So they're monogamous after breeding season, and the quails gather, when they gather into the coveys, they're dispersed during the day for feeding and reassemble at night, especially in adverse weather. The members of this covey of quails seek warmth and protection by huddling in a circle with their heads turned outward. Well, we had a recent incident with the Vice President of United States being involved with a shooting his pal in a hunting accident, and it is fittingly, it is perhaps the ultimate. It was written in the Globe and Mail. It was written fittingly. This is perhaps the ultimate example of friendly fire, for which the armed forces seem to have a proclivity. Then there was another article in the Globe and Mail about Dick Cheney shooting his pal while hunting for quail. Was that it said one could have not have asked for a better demonstration of the Bush administration's incompetence than the National Riflemen's Association poster boy Dick Cheney shooting of his own friend. And there was another comment that said, oh, that more Republicans could know what it feels like to be collateral damage. That was the Globe and Mail letters to the editor published this past week when Dick Cheney shot his friend with, he was shot three times in the head. He mistook him for a quail. Well, David Letterman had something to say about that in his list of 10 items that he often has, it goes from number 10 to number 1, and top of the list was number 2 item was that, of course, Dick Cheney had admitted to having had a drink before, and so David Letterman said, the gun was loaded, and so was I. That's what Dick Cheney said when he eventually reported to the press. And then the number one item was why Dick Cheney shot his pal instead of when he was trying to went goose quail hunting, was that Dick Cheney did it to make George Bush look smart. So I hope you appreciate that humor. It's been considered a somewhat non-event, and Dick Cheney will not be charged with any criminal offense for shooting his 78-year-old pal, who is apparently recovering in a hospital in Texas somewhere. Well, this past week, when I have my music lesson, I meet a little rabbit, and I was reading this book called Stories Rabbits Tell, and I just thought I'd give you a little extract here about how well rabbits fit into human homes. And the reason is because, like their wild brethren, they are gregarious animals who thrive in the presence of other beings. Moreover, domestic rabbits, like wild rabbits, develop hierarchical dominance structures, and this is one reason they were easy to domesticate. So as such, rabbits can easily fit into a household where one human takes the position of the warren leader. And so that's what we know about the rabbits and making good pets. And the SPCA in Vancouver have many rabbits that would like to be adopted and find a good home. And there's stories of rabbits being tricksters, and one of the folk tales that come from this is that the rabbit is in fact a trickster rabbit. It's a mythology, of course, from Native American and some Asian tales. Rabbit uses both cleverness and deceit to get out of scrapes. In a Korean tale, the tiger and the rabbit, that's a story called The Tiger and the Rabbit. Of course, the tiger likes to eat rabbits. The rabbit escapes a hungry tiger by repeatedly tricking him into thinking that there is something much better to eat than a rabbit, like burning hot rocks and twigs. Eventually, the rabbit convinces the tiger that he can catch tasty fish with his tail. The tiger ends up with his tail caught in a frozen river, while the rabbit goes free. Mythology from Korean folklore. Yes, how many minutes do we have left here on Animal Voices? Oh, we're totally out of time. Thanks for listening.